Welcome to Blogging Heads. My name is Gabriel Arana, and I am senior editor at The American Prospect. And today my guest is Tracy Powell. And I'll let Tracy introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Tracy, and I am a contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. I am also founder of All Digitocracy, a blog about diversity in the media. And I am also co-chair of the National Association of Black Journalists Digital Journalism Task Force and vice chair of policy.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me, Tracy. Today we're going to
thanks for having me.
Today we're going to be talking about media diversity. Recently, journalism upstarts like Vox, and which was started by Ezra Klein, who had previously been at the Washington Post, and 538 from statistics numbers guru Nate Silver, have come under criticism for not having enough diversity on staff. And so I'm currently working on a piece that looks at diversity, racial ethnic diversity, at various left-leaning thought publications. So Us, The American Prospect, The New Republic, Harper's Magazine. And I'm finding, I'm still trying to finalize the numbers, but whereas, you know, almost 40% of the country is, does not identify as white, is a racial or ethnic minority, only 10% of the staffs at a lot of these magazines are racial or ethnic minorities. So at first I wanted to talk about why diversity is important, why it matters, because I think a lot of people, so first of all, people who on the right who don't tend to see diversity as a goal worth pursuing in the first place, I think it'd be interesting to explain why it's important, and why in particular it's important in newsrooms. So would you like to speak to that? Speak to that question, Tracy?
Sure. I guess the short answer is we are journalism organizations charged with covering our communities, and Black people are part of those communities. Their voices should be reflected in the content. They should be represented inside the newsroom and in the coverage. That's the easy answer. But because, as you mentioned, the country is becoming more and more diverse, it just makes good business sense that your newsroom is more diverse. It includes people from different racial backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, different social economic backgrounds, different sexual orientation, people from, you know, that represent different sexual orientations. It just makes good business sense because increasingly the country includes, you know, it looks like those people, those different shades, those different perspectives, those different views. So in order to serve the community better, news organizations are going to have to become more diverse themselves.
So I've been in newsrooms that are both more diverse and less diverse, and I can say from personal experience that there's a real difference in the quality of the conversation when there are different people, you know, when there are racial ethnic minorities, as well as women and sexual minorities. Having all these different perspectives really changes the tenor of the conversation. You know, it's sort of hard to describe. I would call the debates that happen in the editorial room with a diverse staff more lively. I mean, you might say more contentious, but that's not quite the right word. There's just, you know, there's an energy there that isn't if you have, you know, if you're having a meeting with four or five older white guys who went to Ivy League schools. So how do you think, you know, how do you think having a diverse newsroom affects the editorial product? I'm sort of talking about the office culture, but, you know, when we sit and brainstorm ideas, you know, having people from different backgrounds on staff, you know, helps us come up with more innovative ideas. So how would you say that the composition of, you know, a staff at a magazine or at a newspaper affects the editorial product.
I think you have a much richer, a much deeper, a much more layered conversation that happens in the newsroom, and those conversations and perspectives and ideas get reflected in the content, in the coverage. And I'll give you one recent example. I won't call names, but recently, in the past week or two, a magazine tweeted a picture of one of the Kardashian girls, and she had braids in her hair, and they called it epic. You know, this was totally new and epic for this Kardashian woman, girl to have her braids. Well, you know, people saw that on Twitter, and immediately, Black Twitter, which carries a lot of a clout on that social media platform, saw it, and they made a complete joke of this magazine. There was nothing new or epic about these braids. Black people have had braids for forever, and not even just Black people, but if you go back to the 1980s, Bo Derek sported braids way back then, and we had the same conversation back in the 80s when Bo Derek came out with her braids. Even before Bo Derek, white women had braids, but it just looked ignorant on the part of this magazine. It looked very ignorant, and Black Twitter called the magazine on it. Now, if there had been more diversity inside of that magazine, chances are that picture would never have been tweeted, or it never would have been covered in the way that it was covered, in terms of this being something new and innovative and epic. It never would have gotten it. So it would have gotten to that point because you would have had those voices inside of the newsroom, hopefully, pulling whoever came up with this idea, they would have been pulling them back a little bit and then reminding them that there was nothing new about this. As it was, because there is a lack of diversity in magazines, the magazine embarrassed itself. And that's what happens unfortunately, that's what happens often when you don't have diverse voices inside a newsroom.
So recently, Vox Media, which is a new journalism upstart, helmed by Ezra Klein, who's formerly at the Washington Post and ran their Wonk blog, made a controversial hire. He hired Brandon Ambrosino, who is gay, but sort of writes a lot of problematic stuff about, you know, the gay rights movement, the gay rights community. And so a lot of people in the LGBT rights community objected to the hire. And, you know, when I spoke with Ezra Klein, he, and it wasn't just him, other people who I've showed Brandon Ambrosino's work to, won't immediately recognize the problem. So, you know, because they're not involved in the gay rights movement, they don't sort of have the same sensitivities as, you know, somebody who is. And so I made the argument that one of the reasons you need diversity on staff is to stop you from making tone-deaf decisions. You know, and it sounds like with the epic comment, you're saying something similar.
Right. I think with that particular magazine, the good thing that came out of that is that they deleted the tweet and they apologized for what they did. So they did, I guess, realize their error. As in terms of Vox, what you're getting at is diversity of thought. And let's just be honest, people tend to hire people for different reasons, but we often tend to hire people that we're more comfortable with, people who remind us of ourselves, people who are people who we know, or people who know people that we know. That's what happens in this business, and so oftentimes that unfortunately results in people who have the same, maybe Ezra may not think the same way that this guy does, but they might have the same similar thought processes, or maybe even, you know, they have a, you know, they this person thinks so differently, I guess, to complete opposite, that they need, they want to, they think that that's diversity in terms of someone who thinks differently than they do, but maybe they still go through the same mechanics. I don't know. I can't speak to that, but I think you are getting at a point about diversity of thought, which is very important. You shouldn't just, I don't think people should hire folks who remind them of themselves. It creates an echo chamber, and that's the last thing that we need in journalism right now. I need to disclose, however, that Vox Media reached out to me and reached out to the NABJ Digital Journalism Task Force in particular in helping to recruit more diverse candidates. So I am working with them to help make their staff, their new staff, more inclusive and reflective of the communities it serves. So I just want to make sure I make clear that, you know, that that's happening.
Yeah, well, that's great, and I think that that provides a good segue into our next subtopic, which is, you know, why do journalistic institutions, I mean, both old print ones as well as new upstarts, have such trouble cultivating diversity? So, you know, even though it's been Vox and 538 that have come under fire for lack of diversity, I'm working on a piece now where I sort of did a tally of diversity at major, you know, thought publications like the American Prospect, the New Republic, the Atlantic, and diversity, racial and ethnic diversity at these publications is really terrible. You know, part of the reason it's a challenge for Vox and 538 is that they're drawing on these existing talent pools. So what would you say, you know, why is diversity such a problem in the media?
I think just what I said, people in power, people in who make hiring decisions, tend to pull from those they already know, or those who know people that they know. So, and that is a problem. People of color don't necessarily have access to those networks, and so we never become, we're not part of the hiring conversation, unfortunately, because we don't know, and again, they don't know us. So that that creates a lot of obstacles to diversifying newsrooms. Now, the other reason is there's a bit of laziness, and again, not calling anybody out, but I've been to job fairs and participated in job fairs where I go to a table and sit down and start talking, and the person I'm talking to has no hiring decision authority at all in the newsroom. They're not even in the newsroom. They send HR people to some of the job fairs, human resource people. These human resource people don't necessarily have news backgrounds or journalism backgrounds. So why I'm wasting my time talking to this person? They have not a clue what I'm talking about. And a lot of talent has been missed for that very reason. And so that was one of the reasons I wrote a piece recently, never saying we can't find journalists of color again. Because a lot of times, people just simply are not looking. And so I came up with a series of steps that hopefully helps people penetrate the networks and bring in and show, hopefully I show them ways that they can bring in more talented people of color, because we are out here and we are screaming. We want to be in the room. We want to be at the table. Sometimes we need an invitation. The invitation to sit at the table is one thing, but there's also the problem of perception. There are perceptions on both sides. I think false perception on the side of the hiring managers is they can't find anybody. That's just a false perception because we're out here. But the perception on the other side of the table among potential candidates is, well, this place isn't particularly friendly to people of color, so I'm just not going to apply. There are several publications who have that reputation and don't know they have that reputation, or if you tell them they have that reputation, they won't believe you. So,
Do you mind naming names?
I won't name names. I won't name names, but there are several publications. Just recently I had someone, I posted a job on our Digital Journalism Task Force Facebook page, and a manager again came to me personally, talked about his problems with hiring candidates, and asked for my help. So I posted the job. I had a couple of people message me privately to say they had some concerns about this company. I took those concerns back to the manager, and he said, you know, these are issues they've been working on, et cetera, et cetera. He also talked about some of the current people of color who are in position there. So, you know, hopefully things will improve on both sides. Maybe people of color don't know that this organization is working to improve conditions at their place of employment. So, you know, there are perceptions. Journalists of color have to take steps as well. We have to attend the mixers. We have to go up to people we don't know, and because the truth of the matter is, we slink back to our default positions of talking to people that we're comfortable around with also. So, I mean, it works both ways. So I think when it comes to these job fairs, when it comes to the mixers, when it comes to receptions, when it comes to networking events, not only do the hiring managers need to do a better job of walking up to people they don't know and shaking their hand and asking them what they're doing, what they're interested in doing, and what they want to do. But journalists of color need to do the same thing. We just need to get to know each other better. We need to be able to knock down these walls that separate our separate silos, our separate networks.
Mm-hmm. So what do you tell magazine editors? So I tend to agree that HR people are sort of useless. You know, often HR people at publications tend to act, you know, as a barrier to the outside world rather than, you know, bringing in talent and a lot of the hiring. So first of all, a lot of the positions, you know, for which there will be hiring won't be listed on the organization's website. People rely on their existing networks, you know, which cuts off, you know, which limits the applicant pool to sort of the networks that people already have. So when an organization comes to you and says, you know, we would like to increase diversity on staff, you know, we put the posting online and, you know, then most of our applicants are white, you know, how do we fix this? What do you tell them?
So I asked first, where did they post the job? I am a strong proponent of using a different platforms to get the word out, to get the message out. But if you're just posting on, you know, one particular job board, I guess, it's not a guarantee that a journalist of color will see that. If you're just posting on your Facebook page or your Twitter account, I can guarantee you almost that journalists of color didn't see that. So my first question would be, where are you posting the jobs? And, you know, when I get the answer that I usually get, I say, well, how about posting with NABJ? How about Journalism Next? Those are places that I would go to, you know, and not just the NABJ website, because we do have an official website where jobs are posted. But we also have these individual committees, such as the Digital Journalism Task Force. You can come directly to the co-chair or one of the officers on the task force, and we'll post a job for you. We have an NABJ digital Twitter account that's more than half of that is nothing but jobs that's coming into us from different hiring managers. And so people follow that Twitter account to see job listings. People come to our Facebook page, to see job listings. So that, you know, you gotta not only in order to get to attract diversity, you got to diversify your efforts. And I think that's important. I think talking to groups, going to receptions, sitting on panels, those are really good ways to reach out to people as well. But as you mentioned, sending an HR manager to a job fair is a waste of money and it's a waste of time. And not just the company's time, but also the job candidate's time. And it sends a really, really poor message out there about your company. That means, for me, when that happens, it means you're really not trying.
So other than ensuring the job is posted at places where minorities will more likely come across it, What else do you tell magazine editors trying to diversify their staff? What else can they do? For instance, does it help when people on staff who actually have hiring authority come to recruiting events, come to panels? Does that sort of outreach work?
Right. I mean, exactly. We need to see your face. We need to know that you actually really care. That is a good first step. You know, we've invited Vox to attend our NABJ convention in Boston this summer. And, informally, they said yes, but I really hope that they are there. I think, the most important thing, Gabriel, is to ask. Just ask. Even if you have not attended an NABJ convention, which you should, but even if you haven't, you should absolutely pick up the phone and call someone in that organization. NAHJ, the Asian American Journalists Association, we're all working to get our members jobs. This is a time when in the past 10 years, I guess, maybe a decade, maybe less, we are seeing an actual decline in the number of journalists of color inside newsrooms. They are unemployed and they are underemployed. We need to help them get jobs. We are available. So if you see TM Powell, which is my Twitter handle, if you see TM Powell on Twitter, if you see me on Facebook, message me. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Google Plus, I'm on all the platforms. All you have to do is message and ask. That's one of the most basic things. And once you ask, we'll help you, we'll help get the word out, we'll help you recruit. And more than likely, that is at no cost, because we really want to get our members employed. Now, I can tell you, I can probably count on one hand how many of those new media startups that you mentioned have actually reached out to NABJ Digital to get jobs. And I can tell you that's been two. And those are just the startups recently. I think the default position right now is we want to hire the best talent. But how do you know you're hiring the best talent when you're not reaching out to everybody, when you're not expanding your reach and getting the message out about your jobs? Mm-hmm. A lot of times the top tier jobs are filled by, you know, friends anyway. And it's not, they don't expand the search at all. But I just, you know, I have to question editors when they say, we can't find any journalists of color, but you haven't asked. And I think, you know, with Vox, to their credit, they did ask. And so, hopefully, you know, we can make some headway there. That's the plan.
So another, so I interviewed a lot of editors, and talked about what, the challenges that they think, they have in recruiting minority candidates.
Okay.
And one thing I heard was that, the hiring process at a lot of these publications, first of all, relies on existing networks, which tend to be elite. So the staffs at a lot of these publications tend to come from selective schools, and then people end up, reaching out to and then hiring people who look like them. But the, I mean, the broader point is that, you know, hiring, you know, by the time, you know, a magazine or publication is hiring someone, they're sort of, you know, it's at the tail end of this, like, you know, long, long road that's like paved with privilege. You know, I guess is how I can say it. I mean, you know, so for instance, one magazine, you know, I spoke to, and this is the case at a lot of others, relies heavily on its interns, you know, to both, you know, their internship program serves as a training ground, and then they also draw staff from it. But the internship's unpaid, and so therefore it tends to only attract, you know, privileged kids who tend to be whiter. So, you know, the frustration that, you know, I've been hearing is that, you know, we're sort of at the tail end of all of these, you know, by the time people get to us, like, all of the, like, institutional gears of white privilege have already kicked in. So, and you know, you're getting only the most privileged people at the end of the process. So how do you respond to that?
So I think there's definitely truth to what you said. And again, I don't think journalists of color want set-asides. We're not talking about set-asides or quotas. We're just talking about being given a fair shot before you hire your friend that you worked with, you know, at XYZ publication. At least open that up so that, you know, I can apply for that job as well. And, you know, who knows, I might bring more to the table than that friend does as you worked with previously. So I you have to open it up from the beginning. You really have to attract the best candidates. You have to consider everybody. I don't want to knock minority fellowships and minority internships. They serve a purpose. But as you said, that's how some of these companies attract their diversity, is through the fellowships and internships. That also means that that you're kind of defeating the purpose. You might be getting someone of color, but you're getting someone very young. You also need to keep in mind, you know, diversity in terms of age as well. That's another criteria. And there are mid-career and senior people out there who are more qualified or just as qualified. Now, the problem I'm seeing at these digital startups is that they don't have the money to pay, or they rule out people before they even talk to them because they think money will be a concern. Tracy Powell is not going to work for, you know, $30,000-$40,000, so I'm not even going to talk to her. Well, I think that, you know, at least talk, and then what I've said to the editors, at least talk, because you don't know. You don't know until you interview this person or have a conversation with this person. You just don't know, so don't rule them out just yet. It's too early. It's too early in the stage to rule somebody out. We're journalists. You're still in your fact gathering stage. So gather your facts before you make a decision about this person's story. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not knocking the minority fellowships and internships. They're fine, but I think we need to look at how effective they are in terms of really having an impact in terms of diversity inside our newsrooms.
Mm-hmm. So,
and I know that also there have been recent court decisions too. I told you my other title is vice chair of policy. There have been recent court decisions that, you know, we now know how they may impact journalism internships. Fewer will be offered. And so that now we're faced with an additional challenge that, you know, some of these internships may not be offered because they don't satisfy federal, you know, they don't satisfy the criteria requirements, federal law requirements. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that might hit us journalists of color again, it might hurt us further.
Yeah. So I know that people are sort of touchy about. So I'll just confess, I know that people are sort of touchy about quotas. But I myself have wondered, I think that sometimes I think that might be what journalism needs, because so in academia, you didn't have, the sort of diversity that produced, Barack Obama until you had affirmative action. And it's because if you have, like a passive commitment to diversity, but then look at the applicant pool that only hire the most, quote unquote, what it comes down to is experience, the most qualified, especially at the entry level, you will get a pool of candidates, and often the minorities of those candidates haven't been able to afford to take, one or two unpaid internships, that have sort of prepared them, to rise through the profession. The profession relies on unpaid internships to a large degree to do training. People who can't afford that are automatically cut out, or when they go to apply for a job, that counts against them. They don't have the same experience. And so one of the things I think needs to happen is that, more places need to be willing to invest in minority candidates who, for all these reasons of institutional privilege, don't, might not have had access to the same opportunities or experiences. And this is not to say that they're less qualified, but they have less experience and they require more investment up front, than somebody who comes from a privileged background, went to an Ivy League, is white, and, shows up in the applicant pool and has all of these internships under their belt. On the surface, it would be easier to hire, the more experienced candidate. But that's where I would say, that publications have to consider, have to make the investment in minority candidates and do, sort of make up for some of the, institutional privilege, institutional racism that, that holds back minorities in the first place. I don't know. I mean, the reason I'm very cynical about places having just a general commitment to diversity and not having it be institutionalized, formalized in some way, because, diversity is easy to talk about. A lot of the editors at the magazines that I've been speaking to are committed to diversity, but yet, for some strange reason, they always end up hiring a white candidate. And I know that academia didn't really start becoming diverse until schools started doing affirmative action. I'm not saying that publications should start their own affirmative action programs, but I think that there needs to be something more institutionalized in order to get minorities in. One of the people I spoke with, said that, by the time you're hiring people, you get this applicant pool and it's, as I mentioned, like the white candidates tend to be much more prepared, tend to, have had access to opportunities that, by that time make them seem like best candidate. And so you have to invest in minorities. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I heard a couple of things in that. So the first thing I want to talk about is younger talent, which is good. But a lot of times that younger talent is hired through an internship program, and they don't necessarily know or understand how to navigate the political landscape inside of mainstream newsrooms. And they wind up not staying at the company and not staying in the industry. And that does nobody any good. That does a disservice for us all. So that's why it's important, again, to hire people from different levels, different experiences, different backgrounds, different levels of expertise. There needs to be a better mix inside newsrooms. So while I applaud digital startups in particular and their emphasis on attracting young people and young talent, I don't think the emphasis should be on age necessarily. It should be more on wisdom, digital wisdom. And you can have wisdom at any age, really. So you can be a 20-year-old out of college and be digital savvy, or you can be a 40 or 50-year-old and be digital savvy. So I think that needs to be the emphasis. The skill set, not necessarily the age, the experience, not necessarily the age, the background, not necessarily the age. So let's try to do both. Let's do both of those things at the same time, because again, we're trying to serve our communities. Now, I heard you when you said invest in minorities. It has been my experience that that's a red flag. Whenever you say that, people start thinking, oh, that means this person will have an unfair advantage over,
yeah,
you know, a white guy or a white woman. So I like to put it in different terms. Invest in your publication. You are not going to survive. Your business is not going to survive if you're only talking to white men over a certain age. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Again, our industry is too accustomed to talking to the white male out there. Mm-hmm. And times are changing. So you got to get with the program. The people there, you know, as the country browns, and it represents just, you know, so many different varieties, different kinds of people, your publications are going to have to change too. So don't look at it as investing in minorities, even though that is a definite benefit. Mm-hmm. You need to figure out how to invest in your company, how to invest in your business so that you can better serve the communities that you're located in or that you're trying to reach. It's just business, basic business 101. Mm-hmm. So there was one other point, and I can't remember it now that we've been talking, but I'm sure we'll come back to it.
The other point I was making is that I thought that, you know, diversity, I mean, has to be, you know, institutionalized as opposed to just, you know, there being a broad commitment to diversity.
Right.
Yeah, and I floated the idea that, you know, maybe quotas would be a good thing.
I know what I was going to say. We talk about quotas, and I think that when you mention quotas, people miss the point. Mm-hmm. You mentioned academia. When we stopped allowing colleges to focus on a variety of issues in terms of their admissions policy, we saw the sudden drop of people of color entering into colleges and universities. The same holds true for journalism. I recently worked on a project where I looked at high school journalism programs, and there's one particular school in the city of Atlanta, which is where I'm from, which is a majority black city. The school is located in a majority black neighborhood in a majority black city. The school is more than 70% black. There are only two black students on that student newspaper. It's one of the best student newspapers in the country, the Southerner at Grady High School. One of the top-notch newspapers. Only two black students on staff. One is a senior, and he's a sports editor. So you have to ask yourself, what is happening that I don't want to say black students are not interested in becoming journalists like I was when I was in high school. I think they are committing acts of journalism all the time. If you look at YouTube or media takeout, you see them shooting video of events happening in their communities and posting the video online. You see them talking about issues about bullying and rape that's happening on their high school campuses. So it's not that they're just interested in entertainment. They're actually talking about and writing about these really hard-hitting news issues happening in their lives. They're just not working on the newspaper, or they're not working in the news program. And I think we need to take a closer look at that. I think that is a direct reflection of what's happening in the industry, the professional industry. Again, in the last decade, you've seen more than 1,000 Black journalists alone leave the industry. We need to look at that. We need to figure out why. I know some have been laid off. Some have quit. Some have just given up because they haven't been able to find a job to make a living at a profession they love. And so they've just given up. But they're also getting frustrated. Mm-hmm. And because they're not able, they're working in newsrooms where they're not able to tell their stories, mm-hmm. where they're having to fight each and every day for the smallest gains. And so they get tired and they leave. That takes a toll on their health. And they start making quality of life issues and say instead, I'll go work in someone's office, PR office or university office where I have job security and I don't have to deal with this stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are other issues that we need to look at besides just I don't want to say quotas because that, again, it turns people off. But there are issues that we need to look at and say, this is happening. When you have more than 1,000 Black journalists, I'm not even talking about other journalists of color. Mm-hmm. Black journalists alone, more than 1,000 have just left the industry. Mm-hmm. You have to ask yourself why. Mm-hmm. You have to ask, these young kids who are deciding they don't want to pursue journalism mm-hmm. anymore. Why? Mm-hmm. I mean, again, Grady High School is a majority Black high school. Why? Are our kids, excuse me, when I asked the advisor what was going on, he talked about birds of a feather flocking together. excuse me, the white students are more intellectually curious. They do more reading. And so they're attracted to the newspaper program there. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about them being more intellectually curious. I know a lot of intellectually curious Black students. Mm-hmm. Why is this happening? And I haven't done the research to find out, but I think hopefully, maybe if I have time, I can.
Yeah. I mean, I'll make this point and then, let you respond then. We should probably wrap up, but, I think it seems like you're pointing to an economic issue where a lot of, kids from minority backgrounds, just culturally, they're, I know that when I was going to start out in journalism, my parents wanted to know why I wasn't, pursuing.
Mine too.
Yeah, why aren't you pursuing something that would make more money? Which I don't think. And my parents had never, heard of most of the publications that, I read or, that would be interested in working in. They had never heard of the American Prospect. I think that, I don't want to speak for all minorities, but, journalism is sort of like an elite profession, and it's, elite in part because you have to dedicate to being poor, take unpaid internships. And I know that my parents weren't, they thought that I should be, I went to college, I should be doing something, more lucrative with my degree. And a lot of the other minorities that I know on staff at different publications, will share similar stories about their parents, not thinking it was a bad idea to go into such a low paying profession, not wanting to support them taking unpaid internships, which isn't, I think that same, that is also a barrier to people, to lower income people. But I think, people from minority backgrounds, you know, also, I mean, there tends to be some overlap.
I think you're right about that. I was talking to a young lady last night who said she left the industry because she couldn't afford it. She couldn't afford to stay. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of truth to that as well. But I think that's when you see some journalists making very good living. you see some journalists on television who are making a very good living off of, you know, their work, but they don't ever, you know, they don't normally look like me. They're not brown, black or brown. So, you know, again, we're getting back to what you were talking about, some structural racism issues inside newsrooms that persist today.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, Tracy, and sharing your thoughts. This is great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to reading your piece.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
You too.